The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Who was John Jacob Astor?
John Jacob Astor was a young German immigrant. He left home at age 17 after apprenticing with his father for 2 years as a butcher, and he had much grander ambitions. He went to London, where he joined his brother in the musical instrument trade for 4 years in the early 1780s while waiting for the Revolutionary War to end in the British colonies. And once it ended, Astor, young John Jacob, left at age 21, took a ship to then the fledgling United States. And on board ship, he heard from a fellow passenger that you could make a lot of money in the fur trade. Astor's capital at that point was a satchel full of musical instruments that he'd brought from London, finally made musical instruments. And he ended up going to the very small at that point city of New York on Manhattan, lower Manhattan Island, only 23,000, and opening a shop that sold this bizarre combination of finely made musical instruments from Europe and wild animal furs from North America, which he exported to Europe. Essentially, he was taking the abundant resources of Europe, meaning its culture, and bringing them to the culture-starved young United States and young New York. And he was taking the abundant resources of North America, which were the wealth of wild animals, and exporting those furs to Europe, where they were highly desired by the aristocracy for fashion. He was a very smart, very focused young man.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors who write from and about the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Peter Stark about his book titled Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. Well, before we get into talking about the adventures that are in this book, I just have to say that it's one of the first times I've ever read historical nonfiction. Well, I would say that it's a page-turner, where I was actually up late at night reading and thinking, I should go to sleep, but I got to wait and see what happens to these guys.
Well, thank you, Cherie. I really appreciate that. I really do, because I've really tried to focus on the compelling adventure story and use that as a lens in which to look at a larger, very important but forgotten era of American history.
And as you mentioned, John Jacob Astor was very smart, and he had an extremely ambitious plan to create a commercial empire that was sort of centered on the West Coast at the mouth of the Columbia River. And the first thing he did was enlist the support of Thomas Jefferson. So let's hear a short passage that tells us about that.
President Jefferson felt that the U.S. government by itself had neither the will nor the funds to extend itself far west enough to settle the far edges of the continent. However much he wished to see it, he thought a Pacific Rim seaport was best left to private enterprise. Astor's timing was perfect. Not long after Lewis reported to Jefferson about the need for a port on the Pacific, a letter posted from New York and dated 27 February 1808 in a flowing, deeply forward, slanted hand, arrived at the President's house in Washington. Sir, it was my intention to have presented myself before you and to have stated to you my wish of engaging in an extensive trade with the Indians that may in time embrace the greater part of the fur trade on this continent, the most of which passes now through Canada. President Jefferson vetted Astor through his New York contacts. He learned that Astor was a man of large property and fair character and well acquainted with the fur and peltry business. The president replied enthusiastically to Mr. Astor. The field is immense and would occupy a vast amount of capital. you may be assured that in order to get the whole of this business passed into the hands of our own citizens, every reasonable patronage and facility in the power of the executive will be afforded. Thus introduced to each other via letter, President Jefferson and John Jacob Astor then arranged a meeting at the President's House in Washington, D.C. in the spring or early summer of 1808.
We don't have records of what happened in that meeting, but it seemed like Astor had this plan to build an empire, and I'm not sure if you're sure if it was democracy or money that was winning out.
Well, it's really interesting, and that's a good point, that Astor and Jefferson each had a vision, and they clearly fired each other up with this vision of the first American colony on the West Coast. Astor was thinking of it as a really trans-global, trans-Pacific trade empire, and he was really trying to corner the wealth of the whole western part of North America, which at that point consisted of furs. There were, you know, no gold had been discovered. Timber wasn't an issue. It was all in furs. And he would take that, the entire wealth of the western half of North America, and funnel it through his own hands, essentially, through the seaport at the mouth of the Columbia. And he would send those furs to China. They fetched huge amounts of money in China. He would use those profits to buy Chinese silks and porcelains, bring those back around the globe to sell those Chinese luxury goods at high markups in London and New York. This round-the-world fleet of ships constantly circling the world, making profits at every stop. Jefferson's vision was a little different. Jefferson saw this, even though he saw the commercial aspect of it as the driving force, Jefferson saw this West Coast colony as the seeds of democracy on the West Coast. And that it would be an empire of liberty, as he put it, and that it would even be a separate country of its own, a sort of sister democracy to the young United States, which then we have to bear in mind how remote and far off this region was. It seems very familiar to us now, the West Coast. It was 25,000 miles by ship around Cape Horn to get there, and very difficult overland. So Jefferson saw that as an empire of liberty, and that it would that democracy and liberty would spread from that side of the continent, from the West Coast, to meet the liberty and democracy that was developing on the East Coast in the form of the young United States.
Well, the first endeavors that happened, a ship was sent off and a party was sent off overland, and we'll get back to the overland party in a minute. But the first ship was commanded by a man named Captain Jonathan Thorne, who was eventually responsible for a fairly huge disaster. So why did Astor choose this arrogant, volatile man to command his ship?
Well, and you have to remember the context of the times. This was in 1810 when Astor sent these two advance parties, one overland and one by sea. At that point, there were a lot of tensions, international tensions going on between the U.S. and Great Britain. The Napoleonic Wars were going on in Europe. Astor chose Captain Jonathan Thorne because he was a great naval hero, and he was absolutely fearless in battle. A 30-year-old guy, he'd made a name for himself in the Barbary Wars by sailing straight into enemy fire against the Barbary pirates off the coast of North Africa. So Astor wanted a man who was fearless in battle when it came to two big ships fighting each other in a cannon battle at sea. Thorne was his man for that. Astor called him my gunpowder fellow, and Thorne was fearless. But Thorne, unhappily, distinctly lacked a human touch. He was really steeped in a very rigid kind of discipline of military tradition, and yet he was put in command. He'd never been in command of a commercial ship before. He was now in command of Astor's ship that was going to found this colony on the West Coast, a supply ship like the first one that came to Jamestown, for instance. And this ship was full of this shaggy lot of passengers who were Scottish fur traders and French Canadian voyageurs and cheeky young educated Scottish clerks. And Captain Thorne was put in charge of this shaggy lot of guys aboard the Tonquin, the ship.
And you suggest that the men aboard the ship represented North American culture in 1810.
I do, exactly. In this book, that's the ship stands as sort of a metaphor in a way, because, again, today, 200 years later, or more than 200 years later, we see North America as so politically stable and founded, and culturally in a lot of ways, too. At that point, the melting pot really hadn't melted. So aboard the ship, you had the Highland Scots, who were the fur traders, who were from Canada. They'd immigrated from Scotland to Canada. They were very much subjects of the British crown. You had the French-Canadian voyageurs, the guys who paddled the canoes in the fur trade, and they had for over a century, close to two centuries in Canada. And they were often of mixed blood, mixed Indian and French blood, more of a happy-go-lucky lot, whereas the Scottish fur traders were clannish and very business-oriented. And then you had these cheeky young Scottish clerks. And then you had Captain Thorne, who was a Yankee, you know, classic Yankee sailor, military guy.
And no nonsense.
No nonsense whatsoever, unlike these Canadians and these French Canadians and these Scottish fur traders. And you had Thorne's crew, which was a crew of Yankee sailors. So you have these different cultures, and the sailors were obedient to Thorne. You have this incredibly dense mix of cultures aboard a very tiny ship, 100 feet long, with 8,000 pounds of gunpowder, 10 cannons, four different cultures, and a really rigid, unyielding captain. It was a volatile combination.
And by the time they were not even halfway over to the West Coast, I'm trying to remember the name of the island, were they on the Galapagos?
No, it was the Falkland Islands.
The Falkland Islands. He tried to sail away without some of the men. He was just going to leave them there.
I think the funniest part of that voyage is just the first night out at sea. I mean, they've just left New York Harbor in September of 1810, and this moment seems so emblematic of the whole trip. Thorne says, okay, lights out, 8 o'clock at night, you know, military discipline. And the Scottish fur traders and, the shaggy Scottish fur traders and the French-Canadian voyageurs and the young clerks, Scottish clerks, are smoking their pipes and talking on deck and say, well, we're not ready to go to bed. We're not done talking and smoking. Thorne says, lights out, 8 o'clock. And they say, no, we're not going to bed. Mr. Astor gave us shares in the Enterprise, so actually we own part of the ship. You can't tell us what to do. And Captain Thorne spins on his heel and turns to the Scottish fur traders and says, the first man who disobeys my orders aboard my own ship, I'll blow his brains out. Relations deteriorated from there. So by the time they got to the Falkland Islands off the tip of South America to put in for water, fresh water, the Scottish fur traders went bird hunting on the islands. Thorne sailed away without them, literally abandoned them there. They had to row madly after him at sea. He was 6 miles out to sea and not coming back until one of the Scottish nephews happened to be on board ship and marched up to Thorne on deck and put two pistols under his chin and said, turn around this ship or you're a dead man this instant.
And it's quite foreshadowing that gunpowder was in his nickname, because what happened to him in the end had to do with gunpowder.
It had a lot to do with gunpowder. And what I find so interesting about Thorne is his lack of cultural sensitivity. And again, he'd be great in a battle at sea. But he eventually, after dropping the colony at the mouth of the Columbia, which became Astoria, now Astoria, Oregon, he sailed north up to Vancouver Island and under orders from Astor to start trading for sea otter furs. He had a very experienced Scottish fur trader aboard ship who went to shore to start trading. A number of Indian canoes came out to Thorne's ship, and Thorne said, oh, well, I'll just start trading myself. He didn't know what he was doing. Became very angry at an Indian elder who was a chief who was bargaining with him. Thorne became so angry, he took a sea otter fur, rubbed it in the chief's face, and threw him off the Tonquin, threw him off the ship. At that point, the fur trader came on board and said, that was a really bad idea. We should get out of here. And Thorne said, oh, what can a bunch of Indians do against a ship with 8,000 pounds of gunpowder and 10 cannon? But the Clayoquot Indians found a way.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Sheree Newman, and I'm talking with Peter Stark about his book, Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire. If you just joined us, you can find the entire program online at mtpr.org/twq. Links to it are also available at our Facebook page. Please go there, like, and share. Stick around. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about why the leader of Astor's Overland Party decided to avoid Blackfeet Country. The second half of the plan was to send an overland party up the Missouri River and across the route that Lewis and Clark had established. But their leader, Wilson Price Hunt, deviated from that plan. He was deterred by rumors of Blackfeet violence in what is now Montana. So explain why the Blackfeet were so hostile and what happened with the Overland Party.
I think this is just so interesting. It was so interesting to research this part of the book and to write about it because, you know, in this region, Montana, of course, played a pivotal role in how the continent was ultimately shaped. And these personalities played a pivotal role at this moment, how the continent was shaped, their decisions under these extreme, difficult situations. So Wilson Price Hunt, 27-year-old New Jersey businessman, had never been in the wilderness before, yet Astor appointed him to lead the Overland Party, in part because Astor knew Hunt would be very loyal to Astor. He was an American, unlike these Scottish fur traders. So Hunt, after some months taking to get there, started from St. Louis up the Missouri with a party of 60 people. That's twice the size of Lewis and Clark. In that party was a Native American woman, Marie Dorion, who had two young toddlers and was pregnant also. She was kind of like a Sacagawea figure, but, I mean, incredibly tough like Sacagawea. As they went up the Missouri, Hunt heard more and more rumors about the ferocity of the Blackfeet Indians and frightening rumors. What had happened was when the Lewis and Clark expedition was up in the headwaters of the Missouri here in Montana, as Lewis and Clark buffs will remember, on the return journey of Lewis and Clark, there was a scouting party sent by Meriwether Lewis or led by Meriwether Lewis up in what's now northern Montana. That scouting party ran into a party of young Blackfeet who tried to steal some of the horses. Meriwether Lewis or his men shot and killed two young Blackfeet. Lewis left hanging around one of the Blackfeet neck a Jefferson Presidential Medal of Peace. And then they literally fled. His party, the whole Lewis and Clark party, just got out of Blackfeet territory. Well, the Blackfeet had not forgotten this profound insult. So the next whites who came up the Missouri from St. Louis were a party of fur traders, utterly disappeared. They were trying to establish a post at Three Forks. No, it's now Three Forks, Montana. They were basically massacred one by one as they went out trapping. So these were some of the stories that Hunt heard as he went up the Missouri. He eventually met three of these trappers who had survived the Three Forks massacre coming down the Missouri in a canoe, one of whom had been scalped in some earlier Indian wars, but he bore the scars of scalping. And these three trappers said, you know, you really don't want to go up that way. The Blackfeet are really ferocious. But, you know, actually we know a better way that you can skirt south of the Blackfeet, just leave the Lewis and Clark route, leave the Missouri River, head around to the south, and we think we can lead you to a headwater stream of the Columbia if you follow us. Well, Hunt was in this dilemma of either following Astor's instructions on the Lewis and Clark route or leaving the river and striking out into 1,000 miles or more of totally uncharted terrain for whites. Of course, the Indians knew all about it. So that was Hunt's dilemma.
The story of Marie Dorion is just fascinating because not only was she the only woman in this party of 60 men, but she was one of the survivors. I mean, a lot of them didn't make it for various reasons, but without giving away the entire story, she ended up living into old age, but she had to spend a whole winter by herself with her 2 young sons. And of course, she walked thousands of miles while she was pregnant. I mean, it's just amazing.
It is amazing. And that's one of the really interesting facets of this history that when I first started it, researching this, I was talking to Sally Thompson, whom you may know, who lives here in Missoula and is a historian and archaeologist who has done a lot of research on Lewis and Clark. And she said, you know, I think Sacagawea and Marie Dorion met each other and said, I really would have loved to overhear that conversation. And I looked into it and they clearly did meet each other. They probably knew each other, you know, maybe quite well. They camped along the Missouri for 2 weeks. What would Sacagawea, having just come back from this long ordeal, have told Marie Dorion, who was just embarking on it? Well, Marie Dorion was an ultimate survivor. Many of these people in her party did get wiped out in one way or the other. She ended up spending the winter in the Blue Mountains under a shelter made out of a horse hide. That she made herself the winter, holed up for the winter, feeding her 2 small boys the horse meat that she'd smoked from the horse she'd killed. Hers is just an incredible story.
Mm-hmm. I have to keep reminding myself that if Astor wanted to send a message to somebody on the West Coast, he had to put it on a ship or give it to somebody who was going to travel across the continent. And so it took months and months and months to get a message to anybody.
The difficulty of communications played a huge role in this, and a huge role in why there is not today a whole separate country on the West Coast called Astoria, which could have happened. It's always fun to speculate under the benign dictatorship of the Astor family. But it took, as you say, months and months and months to get a message around Cape Horn. The message would essentially have to travel around the world for Astor to be in touch with his people on the Pacific. Overland, he was trying to establish a quick communications route over the Rockies, and that was difficult and slow too. One of the big factors that came into play here, and it really speaks to our modern era and our era of quick communications, is that the Canadians, the Northwest Company based out of Montreal, had a far faster system of communications across the continent because they were using these big Voyageur canoes to go up the Great Lakes route and then into the interior of the continent to the Rockies. So they were actually able to deliver messages to their men in the Rocky Mountain region, way in the upper tributaries of the Columbia, far faster than Astor was able to keep in touch with his men. Astor didn't even know if they'd made it for 2 years. It was 2 years before he understood what had gone on. And so what happened at one key moment was that Astor's men had established, they'd actually, you know, laid the groundwork for this colony, for this empire on the West Coast. Things were, after much difficulty, were falling in place after Hunt had become trapped in Hell's Canyon in the middle of winter and starving and on and on and on. They established the toehold. They established posts all up and down the Columbia River, Astor did, and things were really starting to roll for his vision. One day in December of 1812, some of his men were at one of his upper fur posts, which is now where Spokane, Washington is. And in marched a delegation from the Canadian Northwest Company, the rival fur company. And the leader of the Canadian delegation read to Astor's men what was James Madison's proclamation of war against Great Britain. So the Canadians had got news of the War of 1812 months and months before the Astorians did. And the Canadians read this to the Astorians at Spokane and said, okay, what this means is that your West Coast colony is now a prize of war for our Navy. At that point, the British Royal Navy was the most powerful fighting force in the world due to the Napoleonic Wars. The British Royal Navy had 600 ships. The U.S. Navy had 12, and they weren't even all ready to sail.
And they definitely weren't on the West Coast.
And they definitely weren't on the West Coast.
Well, in this book, you suggest that John Jacob Astor's vision, which was supported by Thomas Jefferson, created a schism that still lives with Americans today. What's the explanation for that?
Well, I think that's really one of the most interesting historical points that this whole story raises. And even though I just focus on these years, 1810 to 1813, this is a much larger issue that grows out of those years. That Jefferson saw this as those West Coast colonies as the seeds of a democracy, of a liberty, of an empire of liberty. Astor saw it as a huge commercial trade empire, and it was a money making entity. So, at some point, had Astor's vision succeeded, had Astoria become this powerful colony in a large territory on the West Coast, the question that comes to mind, certainly comes to my mind, is that, was it going to be Jefferson's vision of an empire of liberty or Astor's vision of an empire of commerce? Would those two issues have been resolved in this West Coast colony, you know, in the 1810s or 1820s or 1830s? As it was, because it ultimately failed for many reasons, that question was never resolved, commerce or liberty, commerce or democracy. And I think that it's an issue that lives with us today, and it's really quite a profound issue that lives with us today in U.S. foreign policy, that when it comes to places abroad, other countries, do we as a country stand for a beacon of liberty and democracy, or do we stand for what's in our best economic interests? And it's a tension, if you look at it, that runs throughout our U.S. foreign policy in any number of places in the world over any number of decades. And it's with us today all the time. And I've just really wondered if this would have been resolved, that tension would have been resolved much earlier had Astoria succeeded. I think another really fascinating aspect of this story to me is how leadership made such a huge difference, the personalities of the leaders involved. And I've always been somewhat dismissive of how one personality can change the destiny of a nation. But in this case, the nation was so unformed, and North America was in such a state of flux politically, geopolitically, that the personalities of these leaders made a huge difference. And each was a very different personality. Hunt, very cautious, led by consensus. Thorne, very rigid, military-minded, led by iron-fisted order, and there were several other leaders involved. These were the guys who made these key decisions at key moments in the history of North America, and on their personalities, in many ways, the fate of the western part of the continent turned. And I find that a fascinating part of the story, and I've tried to address that in telling it.
Peter Stark lives in Missoula, Montana, or wherever his research takes him. You'll find more information about him and all his books, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.